As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Paul Sweeney. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. Definitive on our international relations, Ian Bremmer. He is with Eurasia Group. His top risks every year are beyond sobering. One, because they make you think. And two, he's really right a fair amount of the time. Ian Bremmer, should we be stressed that this is a different Republican Party than the Republican Party of young John Bolton with Ronald Reagan?
I'm not sure that that by itself is what drives my concern. I think the fact that Trump owns the Republican Party, and so as a consequence, he can put his thumb on the scale on major foreign policy issues, that's a pretty big deal. But also just generally the illegitimacy in perception of U.S. institutions, the executive, the judiciary, the Congress, but also the public school system, the church, I mean, the media. When you look at how Americans feel right. about their institutions over the last 20, 30 years, it's just been getting worse and worse and worse. And that, to me, is the structural underpinning here.
The getting worse and worse and worse seems to be the heart of the matter, what anybody's politics is. Governor Haley cited out the statistics showing the poll tilt. Ian Bremmer, who is, forget about Spiro Agnew, who is the American silent majority?
I think they're people that feel like their leaders have left them. They're people that no longer believe in the American dream. When you and I were kids, the United States had the greatest class mobility of any of the OECD nations. Today, it has the least. And no matter how optimistic and individualistic you might be as a nation, eventually you get hit in the face enough and you change your view. And I think that that's a big piece of, I mean, the U.S. still has incredible wealth and has all of this entrepreneurship. And you'd rather be at the United States than any other country in the world in the aggregate. But people don't live in the aggregate. And that's what we're experiencing.
So, Ian, I'd love to get your views on how perhaps the U.S. is viewed by, I don't know, our allies, our foes. I mean, it seems like it's been an up and down, whether, you know, with the Trump administration, their policy for NATO and just kind of foreign policy versus Biden trying to maybe get back to normalcy. How do you think the folks outside the U.S. view us?
Incredibly inconsistent.
Yep.
I mean, not a country that you can as easily count on. And therefore, a lot of hedging behavior going on, even though there aren't necessarily any good options. I take the point that we should not be blackmailing our allies to pay or else we won't defend them. But on the other side of that argument, what are we, if for decades they refuse to actually make good on their defense commitments, should there be no consequences at all? Because that appears to be the ex-ante position, and that's not okay either, right? That it's true that if Trump tells you we won't defend you, we'd like Russia to attack you, if you don't pay your 2% into GDP of defense, if you're not doing an adequate job defending yourself, that undermines NATO. And we've heard that from the Secretary General. But it's also true that if Canada and Germany and France and Italy and Spain, I mean, the biggest economies all consistently refuse to invest in their own defense, that also emboldens Putin, right? That emboldens Putin too. So how is it that none of our leaders seem to get it right? We just bounce back and forth between these populist extremes, and don't think long term about what makes for a strong alliance.
So, what do you believe is the realistic future of NATO? And because, boy, that is front and center now with what's going on in Ukraine.
I think that peak NATO was last year.
Okay.
Putin made a huge mistake. You should never, never, ever interrupt your adversary when they're
Right.
screwing up. And NATO was getting more divided and becoming less relevant for many years. The Europeans just were, I wouldn't say they were giving up on it, but they were certainly taking advantage of it. And that led to a backlash that you saw reflected with Trump's America First. And then Putin did the stupidest possible thing. He made NATO as desirable and relevant as humanly possible by trying to overthrow Zelensky and send his troops
Right.
storming toward Kiev. And not only did that make the Germans start spending money on their defense, but it also expanded NATO, made the Finns, made the Swedes want to join, made everybody
Right.
realize that NATO was an indispensable alliance. Unfortunately, Putin understands that he cares a lot more about this issue than anybody else does, and he's willing to wait everybody out. And that now appears to be working in his favor after 2 years of it
Right.
not.
Ian Bremmer, one of my favorite people, is a hockey player from Finland named Alex Stubb. He's young, he's vigorous. I'm not sure the politics in a closely contested Finnish election. Explain to our American audience the importance of Finland and that heritage with Russia.
Well, it does have now of all of our NATO allies the longest border with Russia, and while they had had a comparatively independent policy and were very unwilling, very controversial to join NATO, that flipped the entire population overnight when the Russians invaded Ukraine in February 2022. Interestingly, that wasn't the position despite the invasion in southeast Ukraine with the little green men and the illegal annexation of Crimea. But all of the tanks after the denials, the
Right.
bald-faced lies from Putin to the Germans, the French, the Americans over the months, and then willing to try to engage in full regime change of a country of over 50 million people, that proved enough. And Stubb, who's a good friend, I've known him for a long time. I mean, he is a very, very staunch opponent of
Right.
Mr. Putin. And there's no question
Right.
that the election was not determined by how you view NATO or Russia. In
Right.
fact, both of the opponents of each other were very consistent in terms of policy. There's very different personalities, but there wasn't a lot of substance in this
Right.
in this
There
election.
is substance in Jakarta. It is on the other side, as Patrick O'Brien said, the far side of the world. You feature the Indonesian election. Brief us quickly on that, Dr. Bremmer.
It's another large country after India, big democracy, no one questioning the legitimacy of the process. Joko, the existing president, has been quite popular, and his preferred successor, Mr. Prabowo, a former military general, is likely to win, though probably not in the first round. And his vice presidential running mate is Jokowi, the president, his son. So, I mean, definitely will be more state enterprise oriented, will probably be a little more populist in policy, but very consistent in international orientation, including very good relations with the US and Japan.
Ian, rightfully so, most folks' attention is focused on Ukraine, is focused on the Middle East, but of course, we can't forget about what's happening with China, with Taiwan, that whole part of the world. How do you view China's view of the world over the next year or two?
Their geopolitical position has been really undermined by an economy that's not doing well, and an overly assertive sort of political footprint. And so you look, and of course, India has a much, much stronger relationship with the U.S. and much more contentious and combative engagement with the Chinese, including over their contested border. The Quad has been a strong effort of U.S. architecture building that is a counterbalance to China's Belt and Road. You've got the South Korea-Japan breakthrough, probably the most important diplomatic success that Biden has had over his 3+ years, also problematic for the Chinese. We just mentioned Indonesia, their tilt, but also the Philippines now offering the U.S. 8 military bases after what had been a closer policy with China. If you're China going forward right now, the part of the reason for this charm offensive, it's not just that the economy is going badly, it's that they recognize that they've bitten off more than they can chew, and they need countries to not feel like China's a big bad boogeyman in their backyard. So this has been a better managed policy by the Americans than what we're seeing right now in Ukraine and what we're seeing right now in Gaza.
All right, so I guess let's just start with Ukraine. Where do we go from here? I mean, we're getting into year three here, and I think both sides are probably getting a little tired.
The Russians are waiting them out. I would say the troops are tired, but Putin feels emboldened. And you saw that with his 2 hours plus history lesson with Tucker Carlson a few days ago.
Should Tucker Carlson have done that interview?
Someone should have done that interview, but I mean, I'd rather it be a real journalist, you know? I mean, Tucker is not that. And the fact that he is a fabulist who, you know, sort of supports Putin's position, has been publicly sympathetic to it, I don't think does us any favors. Right. But it's useful for the Americans to hear directly from Putin what he has to say. I didn't mind the fact that the interview happened. I do think that the ability of the United States, the willingness to continue to provide military support, is utterly essential for the Ukrainians to hold their defensive lines. That's getting a lot harder to count on going forward. And we could easily see Ukraine start falling apart.
Dr. Bremer, I got 90 seconds. And this has just been fabulous to go from Governor Haley to Dr. Bolton to Ian Bremer is the way to do this, folks. Ian Bremer, there seems to be a new Pacific Rim after the TPP blow up and everybody anti-China and all that. And that is a projection of the United States across 4 military bases, not up to Taiwan, but across the arc of the Western Philippines. Right now, you got Marco and Duterte going at it again. People talk in Manila about a coup. Are we more in the Pacific Rim than we were 2-3 years ago? Is there a new U.S. projection?
There's no coup coming. This is former President Duterte losing influence and lashing out as a consequence. But the United States remains the only country in the world that can project its military power globally. And China's a regional power militarily. And their economy is not doing so well right now. And that makes the U.S. much more relevant for every country who's in Asia, who may have China as their lead trade partner, but doesn't want to become a supplicant from Beijing.
It is a G. Bremer world. That's a new phrase I'm coining. Not G0, right. G. Bremer. We'll get a new book out of him at some point here. Ian Bremer, just fabulous. And thank you, Dr. Bremer, for the top risks from Eurasia Group that we see.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
We continue strong with another former UN ambassador. He is John Bolton, of course, United States National Security Advisor with the Trump administration, a critic of President Trump, and Ambassador Bolton joins us this morning. Ambassador Bolton, you wrote an essay in the FT a year or so ago, What Happened to the Party of Your Ronald Reagan? Is Nikki Haley the last Ronald Reagan acolyte standing?
Well, she's the last one still running for the presidential nomination, but I think the party at its roots is still Reaganite. I think Trump is an aberration. Obviously, he's been able to capture a significant part of the party, but I think that, you know, one day he will pass, hopefully without doing too much more damage, and we can get back to where we should be. His comments about NATO and allowing Russia to attack countries not spending enough on their defense really ought to be a wake-up call.
Yeah, our Paul Sweeney emailed me this weekend, and he said, get Stravitas. And, of course, to get James Stravitas, the Supreme Commander of NATO, would be lovely. We don't have him today, folks, but we do have John Bolton. What are the ramifications to Europe, to Alex Stubb winning that election in Finland? What's the ramifications to Europe if we get a Trump foreign policy?
Well, it would be disastrous. It'd be disastrous for the United States, but it would be worse for Europe. You know, the Europeans can talk about an EU-style defense all they want. Really, they're going to be led by Germany and France. You know, good luck with that. The problem is, in the United States, for too long, political leaders have failed to make the case that we're in alliances like NATO and bilateral alliances with Japan and South Korea around the world, not out as an act of charity. We're just not being nice to the Europeans by being in NATO. We're protecting vital American interests. We're protecting European interests, too, but we're doing it for ourselves primarily. And the Europeans have not done what they should have done in terms of their own defense expenditures. You know, maybe this will be a further wake-up call to increase, but nobody should be operate under any illusions here. Trump is not trying to strengthen NATO. Trump is beginning the case, if he's elected, why he's going to withdraw from NATO.
And Ambassador Bolton, I mean, obviously front lines there in today's news is just, you know, Ukraine, Russia. What is your latest thinking on how this is developing here and continues to develop in, I guess, the second year?
Well, I think Putin, taking advantage of his conversation with Tucker Carlson, made it plain he's ready to negotiate. And I've been worried about that for a long time. I think Biden wants to put the wars that are going on now behind him for purposes of the November election. He's in deep, deep trouble. And stopping the war in Ukraine, I think he will see to his political advantage, unfortunately. And there are plenty of countries in Europe that would like to turn the page on Russia's invasion in 2022 and before that in 2014 and go back to business as usual. So I think Putin is playing to a weakness in the Western alliance here transatlantically to get a ceasefire.
John Bolton, just because of time here, I have to turn to the Eastern Mediterranean. And over the weekend, the entire zeitgeist to me of Democrats, of those uncommitted, of Republicans, has been wither Netanyahu. Do we intrude on domestic Israeli politics, or is that something distant and remote that the Israelis have to solve?
Well, look, I agree with Netanyahu's view that he should be allowed to pursue the objective of destroying Hamas. He calls it total victory, and in World War II, Franklin Roosevelt set the terms for Germany and Japan to end World War II is unconditional surrender. Given the October 7 attack, why isn't Israel entitled to do that? I tell you, if Biden breaks with Netanyahu, he can kiss the 2024 election goodbye.
So, I mean, to what end, Ambassador, do you think that Netanyahu and the Israeli objectives, which a lot of folks feel like, I'm not even sure how you even measure whether they're achieved, How can you destroy a terrorist organization? From your perspective, what would you recommend to Mr. Netanyahu?
Well, how did we destroy Nazism in Germany? We killed an awful lot of Nazis. You're not going to kill everyone. And it's true, you don't kill the idea, but if enough of its adherents are killed, and the Israelis claim they've destroyed 8 out of the 12 right. Hamas fighting battalions, you can go a long way toward that goal.
But I think, John Bolton, this is so, so important. There's a huge body of Americans, including Democrats, who do not agree that we should support Mr. Netanyahu. Given that American domestic tension, how do we prosecute a foreign policy in the Eastern Mediterranean?
By having leaders who can articulate the reasons why it's of an American interest that these terrorists be defeated. This is not an Israeli war against Hamas. This is not an Arab-Israeli war. This is an Iranian war against Israel through its terrorist proxies. They are aiming to destroy the little Satan Israel. They're aiming to gain hegemony in the Middle East as a whole over the Sunni Arab, their Sunni Arab adversaries. And ultimately, their sights are on the great Satan, and we're sitting in it.
John, thank you. Ambassador Bolton. Priya Misra joins us now with J.P. Morgan. She's a portfolio manager, which barely describes her arch call, which is lower rates, and particularly the inflation-adjusted yield. It's a residual. You take the nominal yield, you subtract some measurement of inflation. Only Bob Michael knows that measure. It's a secret sauce. And you end up with a residual, which is the real yield. Priya Misra, you suggest the real yield will plunge lower. What will be the catalyst?
So I think the catalyst is either the economy slowing down much more than what's priced in, or the Fed, now some combination of the two, or the Fed that's actually trying to lower rates to keep that soft landing alive. I mean, I think the big debate is what is neutral interest rate, real interest rate, R-star, what economists call R-star. The Fed thinks it's 50 basis points. There's some debate. President Kashkari suggested maybe it's a little higher. Maybe it's 1%. And 10-year real rates, and I would look at the 10-year part of the curve. That most of us borrow, households, corporates, borrow in that 5 to 10-year part of the curve. It's running close to 2%. So I would think as inflation comes down, the Fed gets more confidence, as Jeff Powell said, that they can start to normalize, those real rates start to come down, and at least they can get to 1%, which is, I think, closer to neutral.
The gentleman from Yale, Ed Yardeni, suggests productivity started in 2005. Paul Sweeney pointed out to me there was a giant pause during COVID of our more productive, more efficient America. And then we've reinvigorated productivity here. Priya Misra, does a new American productivity that Michael Feroli and Bruce Kasman see, does that change your call on interest rates?
So I think that would be, it would go back to what is real equilibrium interest rates. And I think the Fed's been in the 0 to 50 basis point range. If there is an increase in productivity, maybe that gets us closer to 1%. But here's the offset to productivity. You know, there's a lot of talk about generative AI and technology and how that's improving productivity.
Paul won't stop talking.
It takes a while for that to get adopted within the business sector, within the labor market. It takes a while. So I would say it's not clear to us that we're there yet. Secondly, we've got demographics that go the other way. We have an aging population. And so I would say it's productivity and demographics and population growth that would imply, that would have implications for real neutral rate. And, at least the demographic side is going the other way. So maybe there's a move a little bit higher, and that's why I'm arguing could be as high as 1% real rate. But I struggle to see much higher than that, given how much, time it takes and the fact that demographics are going the other way.
All right, Priya, we're going to have the question, I think, for the marketplace right now is, what is the Fed going to do? Not so much what are they going to do, but when are they going to do it in terms of maybe pulling back on rates? And obviously, the Fed was pretty consistent with their language that it's not going to be in March. Now there's some question in the marketplace. Will they cut in May or perhaps wait to June? What do you think they will do? What do you think that maybe they should do?
So I like that question because we have to constantly think about what they should do, which is driving the economic outlook and asset prices, and then what we think they will do. I think in terms of they want more confidence, which is why they took March off the table. I think they want to see at least 3-4 months of inflation. We have another inflation report this week. That inflation is continuing to come down, and not just the headline number, I think, or core. I think they want to see that the service side of the inflation picture is heading lower, because the goods side has done its bit. Goods inflation is in negative territory. Yep. We're in deflation. I think they want to see that service inflation continuing to come down. You know, May or June, I think it's somewhere in that time frame that we think they'll cut. What they should be doing, I think they should be starting to normalize right here. I mean, the earlier conversation where we're talking about what is neutral, Fed funds is at 5.5. So, you know, even if our star is higher and neutral rate is closer to 3%, we're really far from 3%. So I would have said start early, then you can go gradual, you can figure out where that neutral rate is. But realistically, March, May, June, what's a few months between friends? I think they're likely to start to cut rates sometime in the first half or early in the second half of this year.
Well, you're right. The goods inflation is that's a thing of the past for most people. But boy, the services side, I mean, we have the consumer pretty strong here. The consumer has a job. The consumer's wages are going up. The consumer is spending. Maybe they're putting a little bit more on their credit card, but the consumer seems in pretty good stead right now. How do you see that?
So I think the economic data has been very strong. And, you know, that explains why we've had this scenario of risk assets doing extremely well. The market's pricing in the soft landing. And I think rightly so for now. I'm a little more cautious because I think it's a fragile soft landing. It requires inflation to continue to decline. It requires the Fed to start to normalize policy for the soft landing to last. So I'm a little nervous further down for the consumer. But to your point on inflation, I think rent inflation or housing inflation is a big component of that service inflation. That is heading lower. I mean, we've seen new rents starting to not come down, but the rate of increase of new rents is absolutely slowing down. And so I think that housing inflation, the trend is clear. It's going to come down. To your point, the consumer is strong, but some of that is also, service inflation is not rising at the same rate. So I think what the Fed is likely to do is not wait for 2% on service inflation. But if the trend looks like it's heading closer to 2%, especially with goods in deflation, they can start to get that confidence to at least start the normalization process.
I can't stand, Priya, the phrase soft landing. I just think it's like V-shaped bottom and the rest of it. Let's start with a guy named M. Feroli. You've got to put up with his literature every single day as a portfolio manager. Michael Feroli, Priya, codified under 2% potential GDP. Is our new definition struggle with soft landing that because of technology, because of productivity, we need to lift the Feroli 1.x% potential GDP up? I mean, is that really what we're talking about?
I think if productivity is sustained higher, and this is not just still residual impacts of the reopening or the fact that we lived through COVID, I think it's still early. I would also say a lot of the data we're seeing in the last 2 months can be distorted by seasonals. Seasonals are always difficult to make sense of, the December numbers and then the January numbers, right. Weather effects. I think we need a little bit more data to have confidence that productivity is higher, that potential GDP is higher. But then to your point, how does that feed into soft landing? Soft landing implies below potential growth. So if growth is 1.5 or 2% and inflation is a little over 2%, that would be a soft landing. I think the reason this is so important is, does the Fed take cuts off the table? I think right. That has to be a reacceleration. We have to be seeing growth 3-4%, inflation progress stalling. That's when those cuts start to get taken out. And I think we're far from that. We think monetary policy is still restrictive. We don't see fiscal easing, at least till the election. Right. And so it's a question of when do they start to normalize? What's the pace?
Right.
But we're keeping an eye out for kind of your point. What is potential growth? And
right.
Is that sustained higher?
That's almost a terminal value of the discussion here. Priya Misra, thank you so much. And I can't say enough about a careful read of the J.P. Morgan Combine on research with Joyce Chang and Bruce Kasman have done over there. It's just absolutely extraordinary.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Today's front page headlines: Super Bowl affected. Lisa, I'm sorry you're not at the Fontainebleau Hotel.
Yes. Stuck with us.
Yes, we failed.
My kids might have a snow day tomorrow. I don't know. Yeah.
What do you got?
All right, so we're starting with, of course, Super Bowl, right? Super Bowl commercials. That's what we're talking about. It's across all the headlines, right? Marketers, they didn't want to offend anyone, and so they stayed kind of safe. They use a lot of humor, not controversial humor. You had a couple of newcomers in there. You had Etsy, PepsiCo's Starry was in there. Celebrities everywhere. Arnold Schwarzenegger was there. His commercial was hilarious. Yep. Trying to say neighbor, but he kept saying State Farm, my neighbor, and they kept joking on him. Tom Brady was everywhere, right? They leaned on the female audience. They had Dove, Elf Cosmetics, but the New York Times ranked a couple of them. I want to play a commercial from Dunkin'. This is when Ben Affleck visits Jennifer Lopez at the recording studio. Usher was another one. His halftime performance, everybody was talking about that too. Think about it. 30 years of his career, right? He's 45 years old. He was dancing and moving across the stage.
But to be quickly here, because we got to go on to the others, but I'm going to be able to see all these on YouTube, right?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, you can see all the ads. Yeah,
most definitely.
I'm all like YouTube highlights. That's become my whole life. Next.
You got to do it. You got to
But Usher,
do it.
All right, so the Usher halftime show, it got, like, from people who know this stuff, got thumbs up.
Yes.
Definitely thumbs up.
But it, I know you're getting to a point. Get to it.
No. I thought it was good.
I thought it was good, too, but for people who it didn't kind of tap on their, you know, he kind of said, everybody sing along, and some people weren't singing because they didn't know, and it was awkward a little bit.
I'm not the Usher demo, but I recognized that it was an event, and it was, people were fired up about it.
Yeah, and it ended great. Will.i.am, Lil Jon, I mean, you can't lose
Alicia
Chris.
Keys was there.
Alicia Keys, her. I mean, it was just, he had a lot of people along
with the
with
red
him.
Piano. Okay.
Yes. Next story, I did this because both of you are romantic, right?
So, you can see where that got us.
I know, here we go.
February 14th is pitchers and catchers.
This is about Valentine's Day. This study from McAfee, it says that AI is going to be playing a part in these love letters for Valentine's Day. 40% of adults are at least considering using AI to come up with these love letters for Valentine's Day. But when it comes to men, that number rises to 45%.
45% of men will turn to AI to write love messages this Valentine's Day. I mean, they're doing it just to get their stock up. It's like every other company, a piece of news. But AI.
You get the bonus points in there. Happy wife, happy life.
That's right. What's today? Today's the 12th. Uh-oh, we got to get on this thing.
You got one more, or is that it?
That's it.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen, and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.